it's kind of a key lecture, I think, for the time stuff. And the reason is because we've been building up some of these theories, and it doesn't seem like we've done a lot, because we've just been looking at non-relativistic particle models. And it's not very technical. None of the equations up on the board have been all that technical or difficult or fancy. But I think that the really interesting thing about this stuff is that you don't have to really get into really technical detail to hit all these deep questions that you run into in general relativity as well, where you have all this other technical baggage that you have to bring along with it. And I think that to get to these issues, it would take a lot more than two, 1 hour long sessions. And then maybe the intuition is lost because you have all this other fancy stuff going on. But now basically we're at a point where we can start talking about these problems, and hopefully I've been able to build up some intuition that might help you see where some of these problems could be coming from, at least what I think they might be coming from. So today I'm gonna do some little bit of stuff, and then I'm gonna talk about some observations, I guess. And maybe not provide, maybe try to run a couple definite answers, but then also just suggest some different ideas, because really, I mean, I don't think that the problem of time is going to be solved today or on the board or tomorrow or next week or anything, but it still hopefully will make us think about these things. We'll just remember from last time that we talked about two different theories. One was just Newtonian mechanics written in a root parameterization invariant form. So the action, I called it parameterized particle mechanics. Actually, that's not really the name that I gave it, but some of the people have been giving it for a long time. I think the first time that I've seen this in physics literature was in Dirac's little book called what is it called? Lectures on Quantum Mechanics. He talks about this as an example of a theory of the Hamiltonian constraint. So the action looked like there's some integral over an arbitrary parameter. There's a kinetic energy minus potential energy. But because of this little substitution where we used to have dt in the Newtonian theory, and we changed that into d lambda times a q naught dot. So we just made the substitution, and we got a theory of action that looked like this. And then what we did is we looked at the equations of motion, and we found that we got these Newtonian mechanics back, where this q is interpreted as the Newtonian time. So this theory is defined on configuration space that has particle positions. I'll just write them as vectors. And this q naught, which is the time order. So the solutions are classical trajectories, minimize the action. But one of the equations of motion that we found was that this q naught guy dot was equal to is equal to t over e minus p. And this implied that if we look at our boundary conditions, so on the configuration space we specify some initial q's and some final q's. So the difference between final and initial was this integral here. And if you rewrite this in a way that takes out the lambda, which is just an arbitrary parameter, you can see that this total time that's elapsed between the initial and final configurations is just proportional to the length of this trajectory and configuration space. So you can think of this as the length, but it's not exactly the length. It's a length defined with some funny metric and informal factor. So it's proportional to the, maybe I should say that, proportional to the length. And what we noticed was, so the reason why I'm going through this again was because what we noticed was that here we specify how much time has elapsed. So in this theory, we say 5 seconds has gone by, and then we try to use this action principle to find a possible solution. So this thing is, maybe I'll call this tau, is given. And the thing that is adjusted is the energy. So E is sort of, you can solve for E once you have set boundary conditions. So E is fixed by the boundary conditions. Okay? And T is just specified. So that was the first theory that we talked about. And this was the key thing. And I was going to say that this is the thing that makes it, the role of tau and the role of E in this theory is what makes it a theory with an absolute background. So the second thing we did is we looked at a theory that I claimed has no absolute time, or I don't claim it, Julian Barber claims it. There's no absolute time in the theory. There's just this relational time. And the main difference was the role that these two things play. So let me just remind you that in that theory we had, I called it Jacobi, Barber, Bertotti theory, because Jacobi was the first person to write down the action, but he never really interpreted this theory as a theory with relational time. So that's why I add the BB to it. But it's not Barber-Bertotti theory, because Barber-Bertotti theory is something I'm going to talk about today. So this action is like a d lambda 2 times t, the 2 is outside, e minus v. So this is the action. And we also saw that you could get to this action by starting with this guy and applying a Routhian procedure. So you apply this procedure, well-known procedure from classical mechanics that people use when you have, whenever you have a variable that enters the action only through its derivative. Then you can eliminate that because there's a constant of motion, essentially, which here is the energy. So if you apply that procedure, you get to this theory. And the sort of the nice thing is that the classical theories should be equivalent. So this is the same, well, this theory is defined on a different configuration space. And this is why Julian says this is a temporally relational theory, because now we've removed, we don't have any Q naught, we don't have any variable that's acting as time. The lambda, this thing is reparameterization independent, so or reparameterization invariant, so the lambda is not really part of the theory. The only thing that's part of the theory are these Qs. And solutions are trajectories on this configuration space. So we have some initial particle positions, some final particle positions. And we infer a time elapsed from the solutions to this. So the solutions to these guys are Q classical. And what we showed was that Q classical for the JBB theory was in some sense equivalent to Q classical of parameterized particles. So these give the same classical solutions. But the way that we interpret the theory is very different. Now we get this thing called the ephemeris time, which is just some quantity that we define in the theory. And it's given by this equation, t over e minus v. But now, e is a parameter of the theory. It's not something that's specified by boundary conditions. So in this case, e is now a parameter. So e plays the role of maybe Newton's constant, the speed of light. It's a parameter that you insert into the theory, and in principle is measurable somehow. And then once you know it, then you can infer how much time has elapsed. So again, this is the exact same equation as this guy, right? But the difference is the role play. Over here, tau is specified by the boundary conditions. Here, tau is specified by E. So you set an energy, and it tells you how much time has elapsed through this equation, the classical equation. Now, this thing is the length. It's proportional to the length, again, just like the other guy. of this trajectory, this possible trajectory. So so notice that by changing E, you change the length because E is, or you change the factor of proportionality, which is the thing that makes everything work. Okay. So so the reason why I want to talk about this is because when we talk about the quantum mechanics, we're going to see that even though these classical theories are equivalent, the quantum mechanical theories are very different. And the thing that disappears is that in the quantum mechanical theories, there's an absolute time you can see showing up here. In this one, there's no time. And so then we're going to have to ask ourselves, why is there no time in this theory, but there is time in this theory, the quantum mechanical. Even though here classically there is this ephemeris time. Okay. So is that what we're saying? Yeah. So just remember when we quantized this, we did that last time, we got the time. Okay. So maybe I should just remind you that we got this theory obeyed, the momenta obeyed constraints, and the constraints look like when we quantize them, the constraints look like the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So this thing is acting on the wave function. And the key thing is that we had this guy here, right? We had the momentum conjugate to Q naught showing up in the constraint. So then, if you pick a basis, so you might pick a basis where this thing is dy by dy Q naught minus I, then this looks like the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So it's an interesting way of deriving the time-dependent Schrodinger equation from this theory. It's not the way that you typically do it, but that was the key thing, is that here you have this variable. Now, what happens when you quantize this theory? Simply, well, it's really easy to see what happens. So, remember, this theory has momenta that obey constraints. And the constraints look like, there's only one constraint actually. And it looked like sum over I, pi squared over 2 mi. So this was the constraint that we had for this theory. So when we quantize, we send the phase space variables. Go to operators. And the Poisson brackets turn into commutators. Then, because we have a theory with a constraint, we have to use this constraint. If you just use the Dirac procedure, you have to use this constraint as something that is acting on the wave function. So this turns into an operator constraint on the wave function that looks like you put a little hat, and you put a hat here, and a hat here, and you say this is equal to zero. But then what you realize right away is that you put a hat on these guys, but you don't put a hat on this thing. It's just a parameter, it's just a constant theory. And so this is the time independent Schrodinger equation. So time independent Schrodinger equation. And so this is the thing that's analogous to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation of general relativity. And in fact, the reason why the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is time-dependent is exactly the same reason why this is time-dependent. And we'll see, maybe OR in a couple lectures, that when you use Julian's approach, this Jacobi principle, and then the best matching for typical relationalism, that actually the energy plays the role of the cosmological constant in relativity. And so this equation looks identical, completely analogous to the Willy Wood equation. So, so this is what people call the problem problem of time. And it's, you know, very confusing. Why? I mean, it's confusing. The thing that was actually the most confusing to me at first is here you have a theory whose possible limit, there is an emergent time. And then you quantize that theory, and in the quantized version, time disappears. So how do you expect to recover time in some sort of possible limit, right? That's sort of one thing that confused me originally. But actually, the solution, the way that you can see time coming back into the theory is through the path of the real approach, which we'll talk about just in a second. But then, I mean, what do you do with a theory like this? Like, there's no T at all. And okay, so let me start over. What is the main difference? Well, obviously the main difference is that here we don't have an operator conjugate to time that we can promote into an operator. That's why I spent so much time saying, look, the roles of E and T are different. Here, E is just a parameter. Here, E is specified by the boundary conditions. So it's the different roles that these things play that contributes to the disappearance of time. And maybe it's better just for me to sketch out, maybe give you some intuition, or try to give you some more intuition about what's going wrong, why we're losing time. So in order to do that, so let me see, just say this is the disappearance. To me, the path integral is really, really enlightening. So what happens with the path integral of these things? So if we compare this JVB theory to Ventura's particle, what do we find? So the idea is, these are the two different configuration spaces, right? So here, we have some initial and final. Here we have the same thing. Q initial. But we also have the Q naught initial. And here we have final, final. So when we use the path integral, what are we going to do? We're going to sum over all paths, right, in configuration space. So our configuration space path integral is going to be this sum where we exponentiate the action. And we're going to look at we're going to add all the different possible trajectories that you can take from the initial to final configurations. But of course, what you do is you fix the boundary condition. So you say, I start here and I end here, right? And the difference is that in this theory, you do the same thing. So you have all these different trajectories. You're summing over. Here you do the same thing. But the difference is that here, you're fixing these boundary conditions for T. So what does that do for you? And I think that I probably shouldn't have written on this chalkboard first. Because now this guy's going to disappear if I lift him up. So why don't I keep this thing going over here? I mean, What I want to say is, okay, so if we sum over all paths, this thing, Q not final as Q not initial, is fixed. Okay. Now what happens is, suppose that, okay, it's not really what you do, but let's go back to this formula. Alright, so here you have a classical trajectory and it gives you a particular energy for a certain time. In the path integral though, we're not restricted only to the classical path, but the sum over all paths. So here we're going to put all kinds of different. So if we have some, we can calculate a particular energy for each different path that we're going to put in our path. And so what this is kind of doing is it's giving you a superposition of these. Because effectively, each different path gives you a different energy for a particular set of fixed boundary conditions, right? But because we fixed the time, we're still going to have time here at the end of the day. But in the JBB theory, what do we have? We have this other same equation, but now E is fixed. So when we do the same thing, when we sum over all paths, each path is going to have a different sort of ephemeris time associated with it, right? So because we fixed the energy, we put a different path into this integral, and it gives you a different elapsed time. So what this is going to do is it's going to be equivalent to an average over all times. And I know that this is a very sketchy thing to say. I actually started writing this and I realized that what I've done is just say a lot of hand-wavy things. And the reason is that I've done that is to try to give you intuition. But I can promise you that you can make this more rigorous. So this is my first paper on the archive, I invite you to check the archive. I don't have the reference on right now. In my first paper, I go through all of this, and you can make all these arguments rigorous. When you look at the path integral, in fact, because of these are gauge theories with constraints, you look at the phase space path. And then what you get is you get some equation that looks like some object like this. In this theory, you can pull that guy all the way through the phase space path integral, and you're okay. But here, in this theory, you can't do it. So what happens is when you integrate over all the paths, this averaging procedure actually happens. You have to believe me that this can be made more rigorous.
Is this average over all times, is that the classical term?
So what I'm saying is that here you have, in the classical theory, you have this, you define this quantity that you call the ephemeris time, and it's given by this expression here. So you say this is the amount of time that's elapsed. Now, of course, in the classical theory, you just have the classical equations of motion, so it makes sense to do that. Off shell, you can sort of try to do the same thing. You say, let me try to define a clock by taking some random path and saying, this is the amount, I'm going to try to do the same thing. I'm going to suppose our system went through this path instead. Maybe we did a measurement and found out this path went through. So somehow we know that. How much time has gone by? Well, maybe what you could use the same formula. And what you would find is that it would be different for every trajectory. The thing that I'm trying to say is you can think of the path integral as some sort of superposition of all the paths. In the classical theory, you're going along this classical trajectory. And on that classical trajectory, you have a well-defined, meaningful time. Because you can say, this is how much, and this is where I've gone, and this is how the universe has evolved. So I can tell you how much things have changed relative to each other, because I know where everything was, and I know the history of the universe. But quantum mechanically, we don't have this nice picture of the universe going along a particular trajectory, right? So we have some sort of fuzzy thing going on. And the path integral, to me, is a nice way of thinking about it. So you've got all these paths that you're summing over. It's not literally an average, but you're summing over them in this particular form. And what you get is, for each possible path, you get a different amount of time. So at the end of the day, when you look at the contribution of all of those different times, you don't have a good one to pick. So you just, everything gets washed out, and you're left clearly with no time. So, I don't know.
No, I'm happy with the notion of a path integral,
maybe I should go into more detail.
Just not sure what average over all times mean.
I haven't defined that. Yeah.
Trajectory?
I haven't sort of defined it rigorously. So maybe I could. I sort of realized when I was talking that this is actually a lot sketchier, because you guys haven't done the calculation. So maybe what I could do is I could go through what I did in my first paper in more detail. The problem is it gets ugly really fast, right? The notation gets ugly and the equations get very long. And at the end of the day, the intuition that you get is the one that I'm trying to convey now, but maybe I can do a better job, yeah.
So a related question to this, if you just fix E and determine E, some paths using this equation will have a complex time. So do you sum them over two, or do you only restrict the paths who have a real time?
What do you mean that they have complex time?
Because you can have a negative number in square.
You could have a negative number in square.
If your V ever gets bigger than the E.
Yeah.
Or maybe you also get a negative number on top.
So then you get into weird situations, right? Because when this thing is, it gets imaginary, you have tunnels, right? So it's the same situation in classical mechanics, tunneling. So what is the potential is bigger than the energy. So in that case, you might have some sort of imaginary contribution to T. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what's observable? And so what can you actually measure? And so I think what you find is it's the same thing you find in normal quantum mechanics, where you have these tunneling things, like you can actually observe the particle while it's tunneling. So maybe this idea of time is not very well defined in those regions, but then in places where you can actually make measurements, it's real.
So I think I was actually asking something much simpler.
Well, okay.
So does this ever get negative inside, first of all? Because I mean, maybe it probably gets negative when on top and the bottom is the negative. And if it's negative, do you include them in the path integral? That's all.
So you would do this. I'm just saying that you do it the same way you do it in normal quantum mechanics, right? When you have the places where this thing would go imaginary are the same places in normal quantum mechanics where you would have. So that's, and then I think you would treat it the same way. It's hard to know, I mean, I haven't worked it out exactly, but I suspect that's fine. So any other questions? I realize this is, maybe I should define what I mean by an average, but it's maybe I should put this on this, right? All I'm trying to do is sort of paint the picture here of what is going on. And so, for example, you can see right away. I think what I'm trying to say is that the reason why you don't have time in this theory is because you don't know where things are anymore. So in quantum mechanics, you can't say, look, the system is here and it went along here and then it ended up here. That picture doesn't make sense quantum mechanically anymore. Being able to know where the system went is very important in this definition of time. Right? So in the way that we define time in this theory classically, we really need to know where the system went. But in the path integral, in quantum mechanics, you don't really know where the system went. And so now if you try to use this same notion of time, that breaks down. And so the result of that is that now you don't see any variable in the Schrodinger equation anymore.
Wait a second. What is your statement? That in JVB one has time or one does not have time?
One does not have time. That is true.
But you do have an average time?
What you have. Oh, I see.
No, sorry.
I see what you're trying to say. So when I now I understand. So you say if you average, then you get All right, so let me back up. Now I understand why you're very confused. So maybe I should change that. What I mean is that you have a superposition of times. Right? So maybe that's what I should say.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So
I've seen that before.
You've seen that. Okay. So here we have a superposition of energy states. Here we have a superposition of times.
Yeah, which is not a time.
Which is not an actual time. Right? So you mean each time is given by sort of a different. You get a different time for all these different off shell projections that are allowed. And so at the end of the day, you don't really know what to do, and you're stuck. Because you don't have a good clock. Of course, then the issue is, well, what about the classical limit of this? Right? Why is it that this in the classical limit of these theories are equivalent? But I can sort of see that right away. What happens if you take sort of the stationary phase approximation? Because in the stationary phase. What do you do? Well, for those of you who know path integrals, you just approximate the path integral. By just the single path, the classical path. So what you do is instead of taking this giant sum over all paths, you take a single term and you write it as e to the I s. Be evaluated at the classical solutions. So you say for some reason our system is heavy or it's in this weird state where it's well approximated by just one trajectory. So even though all these other trajectories are possible and in principle you have to sum over all of them, their contributions to the overall path integral are not going to be very large compared to the contribution of this one path. And so then what happens is you say, okay, it might be true that you have a superposition of times, and you have all these other times that are not really well defined, but there is one preferred time, and that's the one that's given by the classical trajectory. And in this approximation, the system is very well described by that classical trajectory. So that gives you a good clock. This tells you that T ephemeris is a good clock, is good. And you recover time. So again, a lot of words, right? It's just really, really ugly writing all these equations down, and it filled the blackboards a lot to make it rigorous. And you can really see that happening. Why am I going through the time to say this? And that's because of something that I've noticed in the literature. People try to say, okay, how can we get time emerging from such a theory? There's no time in the general theory, but maybe what we can do is we can find a way to get time to emerge for subsystems of the universe. So this is the Hamiltonian for the entire universe. There's I particles, sum over all I. And there may be many, many, many particles in the universe. The solutions, this wave function might have degenerate solutions. And using those, that degeneracy, you might be able to sort of trace out over many degrees of freedom and find that the theory that you're left with is some effective theory. That looks like it's evolving according to some time. And that's what people have been trying to do. And I guess the hope is that somehow you can get time to emerge internally from the system. And they've been successful only in certain cases. So
what you demonstrated in the JBV is not the emergence of Ifimeo's time from the quantized system. You just reproduce the same classical formula.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that in a classical, if the system is described by, is well approximated by this the approximation here, then
you can take that classical solution.
Then the classical time is good. Yeah.
But you have not yet shown us an intrinsically whole.
That's right. Is there a general way to do it? And people have been trying to do this for a long time. I don't think it's possible.
But that's not a new discussion.
No. I think that it's not new, but I think this way of thinking about it with path intervals is new. And I think that it's sort of like, it's almost, you sort of get to it right away, right? You start thinking about these superpositions of different, like different off-shell paths leading to different times. And then all of a sudden you understand all these results that people have been working on. And it's because the people that have been working on this are Klaus Kiefer. How do you spell his name? Anyone know how to spell his last name? Klaus Kiefer, KK. And then these people with like quantum information backgrounds. So what they do is that they start with these horrible sort of degenerate spectrum, and they try to trace over to use the frame and make approximations everywhere. And what they find at the end of the day is that you can get a meaningful time emerging when there's heavy degrees of freedom. So the idea is that you have these heavy degrees of freedom. And these guys are essentially things that obey are well approximated by the stationary phase approximation. They're classical, or approximately classical algorithms. And so these things give you a given time.
Well, hold on. But isn't the presence of such a heavy object the same as having a background?
Yeah, exactly.
So why do you solve anything?
Because I think that's the point, right? It's not really a solution. And I think that the idea is that people are starting with this and saying, okay, now once we've developed this formalism, then we can try to take it further and try to see if we can find an internal time emerging generally without any types of. But I'm not sure if that's possible.
Why do you call them heavy?
They're heavy
what
because they're.
Specific?
You don't take a superposition.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh.
So they're just. They're heavy. They're like this chair is heavy compared to an atom.
So you have a classical, a lot of quantum mechanical problems go away if you have a classical object in the room, right?
Exactly, right. I think this is really important. And then there's light, degrees of freedom. And these things evolve, quantum mechanically, according. This time. So what they've been able to show is that they use huge amounts of approximation and there's a lot of machinery. And at the end of the day, what they show is if you have heavy things, they will, produce some sort of background time for you. And then the sort of light degrees of freedom will evolve part of that time. Theory works. But that's not actually such a surprise to me when I was doing this because if I have this large path interval here with heavy degrees of freedom and the light degrees of freedom, well, what can I do? Well, I could say, okay, this guy's well approximated by stationary phase approximation. That will give me a useful notion of time. And then what I'll do is then I'll just integrate over all those degrees of freedom. And here I'll be left with some effective theory that hopefully will look something more like the path integral for this guy. So using various approximations, and after integrating over the effective theory should look like a path integral for this theory. And then you're done. Because this theory has a time where sort of this guy, this tau, these boundary conditions are fixed somehow by the time given by this theory. And then you're done.
Which part of what you're doing is special to JBB? Because I mean, these black holes you could be writing for any problem theory, quantization of GR, right?
Yeah.
So what's special about JBB and what's going on there?
Well, I mean,
or is it not?
I don't think it's special.
Quantization of GR.
Yeah, any quantization of general relativity will have exactly the same.
Oh, okay.
So the difference in general relativity is if you have a local time, right? So we might see this later, but the thing that plays the role of T here in GR is something that's a function of space. Basically, you have refoliation variance in
mm-hmm.
general relativity,
yeah.
And that makes things much more complicated. And it makes it hard to see these things coming out, I think, because you have this huge extra invariance. You have an infinity of Hamiltonian constraints instead of just one. And maybe the idea is that one of those Hamiltonian constraints is actually generating of evolution time, and that would be the thing that would be there.
So this is supposed to be a bit simpler.
Yeah, this is supposed to be a lot simpler because, well, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't write the equations for the path integrals, but they're not, they're long, but they're not difficult. Right?
Yeah.
And of course, what this guy is doing is very, what Carlos is doing is a little sketchy, it's complicated because he has to make all these approximations.
He does it on JBB or in relativity?
I believe he does it in JBB with his Jacobi theory.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Without spatial, he hasn't added spatial relations.
Okay.
It doesn't add much to the discussion. This is the other thing that's weird. So as Robert Brown has a paper where he just looks at mini superspace, and he treats the the scale parameter as a classical, and then he puts a scalar field onto the mini superspace, and then it's the A that's giving you a good plot. And then you can prove that the scalar field evolves according to a time dependent sort of Wheeler DeWitt like equation. But according to the time given by this A. So the point is he did exactly that, but instead of in full general relativity, in mini superspace. So actually, in mini superspace, this JBB theory looks very, very similar to general relativity. It's almost exactly the same theory. And so he did it. And what's interesting is that I was just talking to him, and he told me that he did it with the paper. And it agreed completely with all the intuition that I would expect it to come out of this. But it seems like in order to get this time coming out, you really have to assume that you have some sort of classical thing. So I realize that this lecture has been very handling, but I'm going to make it even more handling now and just say, make an observation that, that it seems to me that this program is probably going to be successful, that you could get time to emerge this way, and that, you know, these results of Klaus Kiefer and Robert Brown and other people sort of hints that this is possible and you should be able to do it. And I think for the reasons that Fotini just said, it's sort of like you're implying you have this classical background already, and you're not making any claims about where that classical background came from and how it came to be. And to me, I think you need this, right? Because if you just have this path integral with these arbitrary sums, you have all these possible relational times. And if you're going to think of time relationally in this way, then you have no hope of getting a relational time out of general relativity, just because you have all these crazy paths, which and for each different path will have a different time. But if you have a classical background, it seems that you're okay. And that's the thing that's interesting, is that that's the same thing in quantum mechanics. It's often true that if you have classical objects, it solves a lot of problems. But why is it that we have this this issue in quantum in the foundations of quantum mechanics, but we also see this issue in general relativity? So to me, it suggests a link between, I guess, the measurement problem and the problem of time, because it seems to me that in order to have a well-defined clock, right, you need to have a classical object somewhere. And in order to have measurement, to be able to talk meaningfully about the measurement, you also need to have this classical object somewhere, a classical observer that can make measurement onto a quantum system. So I mean, maybe it's just a coincidence, but maybe it's pointing to something deep. There might be a connection between the measurement problem and the problem of time. And I think that you can see that happening just in this very simple theory almost right away. Like I said, I just want to point that out as an observation. Incidentally, if you try to use Bohmian mechanics or something as a way of solving the measurement problem, now you have a particular trajectory, you also now have a well-defined femoris time, right? Because you just stick the Bohmian trajectory into this equation and you have a well-defined time. I think that's why I first started getting interested in this, because he likes Bohmian mechanics. And then he told me about it, that's when I got interested. But I got interested for different reasons. But the problem with the Bohmian trajectory is they're not observable, right? So it's very nice to have this meaningful time, but is it well defined operationally? Probably not. So anyways, it's an interesting thing that maybe thinking about this from this perspective, the measurement problem, the whole time from this perspective might be revealing. Those are sort of the sketchy observations that I wanted to make. I don't know. I'll have to ask you guys after if anyone thinks it's a good idea for me to make statements like that in my lecture. But I mean, that's the fun part. And that's why I said this at the beginning. This is a fun lecture, because it's sort of, we get very quickly to things. I guess I'm kind of running out of time, but I want to make one more observation, I guess. I promise that the next lecture is going to be very precise mathematically, because really the next stuff is the spatial relationalism, and for some reason that seems to be a lot more clean cut. You can deal with it, and you can write down there's solutions and you can, for some reason it seems to work.
It doesn't have time.
Yeah, it doesn't have time. The time is the messed up thing, right? So I think it's important to realize the time is the messed up thing. That's what I'm doing right now. So I mean, that's why I'm not giving you definite answers. But in the next lecture, I'm going to go and I'll write down equations. And I think that's going to be the really interesting part, is that you can really write down a precise prescription for implementing spatial relations. So before I actually get into that specific, nice mathematical stuff, I want to make one more statement. And that's just about, I guess, another observation that reparameterization invariance is very different from other types of gauge invariance that you find in physics. So this is a comment about reparameterization invariance. In a gauge theory, normally, you have some configuration space, and I draw these pictures a lot, in this case, the gauge theory, you have this configuration space stratified by these bundles, so these equivalence classes of states. The idea is maybe this is a U1 bundle, and you do a U1 transformation, and it moves you along this equivalence class. It doesn't change the physical state of the system. So you have all of these gauge transformations, great. And the generators of these gauge transformations are first class constraints. So whenever you have first class constraints, that is constraints that commute with all the other constraints in the theory, then they will generate flow along these equivalence classes. Okay. So this is gauge theory. This is the standard picture. And now, this Hamiltonian constraint is a first class constraint. It's the only constraint in theory. It commutes with all the other constraints because it's the only one. So you could say, well, you know, Dirac conjectured in 1930, or no, maybe, I don't know when he conjectured it, but that all first class constraints will generate gauge transformation. So this Hamiltonian should also be generating a gauge transformation. Then you can say, well, what is that gauge transformation? Well, it's just something that's reparameterized in normal trajectories. So I do a coordinate transformation, I change to a new lambda, and I have the same physical theory. So that's my gauge transformation, right? Well, it's a little bit different from that, and that's the observation that I want to make. But here we have what we have in a reparameterization invariant theory is we have a configuration space. Then we have some solution, and then we have a lambda going up like this, right? And the idea is that solutions to this theory will start along here somewhere, and then they go here. And then if I do, change the parameterization, I'll get some other crazy function that might start at a different place even. And go up and down, do something weird, and end here, and then I can have many different other, infinitely many different other parameterizations, and all of their projections, these guys will all project down essentially onto the same trajectory here, so that they give you the same theory.
Shouldn't it be monotonous, that curve though, going to lambda, because you're integrating?
That's a really bad drawing picture, so it was like...
No! Look from the wrong angle.
Oh, I see. I'm looking for it. No, I just thought maybe lambda initial and lambda final had to be... one had to be bigger than the other and had to be monotonous.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It should be a little bit. So there is an assumption that the lambda is sort of increasing.
Or always decreasing.
So it should be a bit more careful. But you get the point, right? So it should be monotonically increasing function. So these are probably not the right paths to draw. But you get the idea. You can draw many, many different paths at all times. And provided they obey those consistency conditions, then you have So then the idea is, okay, well, now my Hamiltonian constraint should be generating flow along these. My point is that this is very different, right? Because what are the equivalence classes here? Can you draw them the same way? Are these things that stratify the configuration space? No, they're not, right? Configuration space is not stratified by any equivalence classes. There's just one trajectory in the configuration space, right? And the Hamiltonian is pushing you. I'll show you what the Hamiltonian is doing. You can see the picture very clearly, right? So let me just draw the base of this. So suppose we start here and here. Suppose we're at this point here. What does the Hamiltonian do? Well, the Hamiltonian tells you where you're going to be in the next instant, right? So the Hamiltonian is pushing you to a new point here. And this is very different from what's happening in a normal gauge theory, because here the first class constraints are moving you along an equivalence class. It doesn't change the physical state of the system. So if you're at some point in the configuration space here, you can move. So the constraint will move you to a new place that's physically equivalent. Here, the Hamiltonian is pushing you to a new place in the configuration space. It's not moving you to a different physically equivalent state. You're moving to a new physical state of the universe. So the Hamiltonian constraint is not generating a gauge transformation. It's not bringing you to a new state. But I'll tell you what it is doing. Right? And I think that this is the reason why there's been a lot of confusion, because it seems like it.
How does it push you to the next spot if it annihilates the state?
We go to the classical. You apply the Hamiltonian to a point in the configuration space. It gives you a new point on the configuration space. And that's why the Hamiltonian is generating evolution. Okay. So what is the Hamiltonian doing? Well, if you take the Hamiltonian active on this point, it'll move you over. If you take the Hamiltonian and you act it on a state here, it'll move you over here. If you start here, it'll move you here. If you start here, it'll move you here. Let's start here. So what is it doing? Well, suppose you consider your physical state as the collection of all possible, as a history. So if now you take the point of view that history is a physical state, now you're in business, right? Because the history is the collection of all of these points. And if I take my Hamiltonian constraint and I push all of them, what is it they're going to do? It's just going to reshuffle all the points on this trajectory. And at the end of the day, you have the same trajectory, the same history pattern. So what the Hamiltonian constraint is doing, or the Hamiltonian in this case, what this constraint is doing is it's giving you a new history that is physically equivalent. So in this case, it's the history that is unchanged. Whereas in this case, it's a point, the physical state system is unchanged. But I think that this is a very strange thing to do. I mean, we never consider a history of something to be a physical state. The state of the universe is right now. So,
In GR, you have a metric, right? It's a four-dimensional thing. So
yeah.
It's an entire space-time.
Right, but in general relativity, the equivalent, the configuration space is superspace. Then you have the exact same thing. Right? You have you have a history on superspace.
A metric is a point in your superspace.
Yes.
Which
a three metric. Yeah.
A three metric. Yeah. No, a four metric. Well, superspace, you're doing 3+1, but
then
you would have a history, yes, indeed.
Yeah, okay.
But I was saying that it comes from a four metric.
Okay.
So the full theory has a space-time metric is the analog of a history.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the history is the evolution of the physical state? And the gauge transformation, you can look as some evolution in redundancy, which doesn't mean
that's right. So this is a type of redundancy. I just think it's important to recognize it's a different type. So what you're saying, okay, so in the, I mean, I think that if you want to think of general relativity as this static four-dimensional metric, then it really changes the way, I think it's a radical change in the way that we think about physics. To think about things that way. I think that's an important point. And typically we think of an instance of all. And if you use that 3+1 picture, then you get this.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But
how does it work quantum mechanically, this thing? Because you don't really.
Yeah, so quantum mechanically is even more confusing. Right? Because
you have how does it work? Because if you have a state, if it's you don't. So here, you don't have a problem because any particular configuration is a physical configuration.
Yeah.
Right? So then you use this
to push it
using the Poisson bracket and push it off.
Yeah.
But how does that work quantum mechanically? Where for some reason, do you suppose that not all states are physical? Or do you suppose that all states are physical
In quantum mechanically, it's the picture you have to think about it a little bit differently. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's often so that all first class constraints generate gauge constraints. You have to be very careful. Now, again, you can make this more precise. And so there's a paper by Barber and Foster. They take a completely different approach than what I just sketched on the board. Right? So Barber and Foster. Where they they look specifically at the Dirac's theorem, or conjecture. All first class constraints generate gauge transformations. And what they notice is that in his proof of the theorem, that T plays a very important role. So T is the canonical variable here, the thing that's the analog of lambda in this case. Okay? So if you have this T you can show that the gauge transformations are going to bring you to the physical state. But when you have a reparameterization invariant theory, then that T is now a lambda, and that thing is also changed by the it's more complicated. So then what happened is the theorem breaks down, basically. And you can show that very precisely. So all I was really trying to do here is show that these physical features work too. And actually, Kutbach pointed this out in general as well. So he pointed out in the same thing. He didn't go into much detail. All he said is, look, if in the 3+1 picture, you have a metric, and the metric is being pushed as in by the Hamiltonian, and that's a new physical state. So it's different. And then he goes on to do other things. But what I like about this paper is actually they go and they look very specifically at this theorem, and they say this is where it breaks down for reparameterization theory. Now, what does that mean? They don't make any claims to that. And of course, the general relativity is more complicated because you have refoliation invariants, and it makes everything more complicated. So, because you have an infinity of Hamiltonian constraints, it's hard to really see precisely where this might be applicable in that situation. But it's an observation that we have to be careful, and that it's reparameterization is very different from normal gauge invariants.
So for conclusion, you could also pull back the gauge description to a coordinate map and have a reparameterization invariant gauge formulation. Make things even more messy.
Yes, yeah.
So maybe that's the whole direction is the wrong one. Maybe you want to move the other way and really nail down the physical degrees of freedom.
Yes, yeah.
And quantize that direction.
That's right. I mean, what it does is it kind of puts into question the direct procedure for these particular types of theories. I don't want to say that the direct procedure fails or anything, but I don't think that it does. We applied the direct procedure to this theory, and we got a perfectly sensible quantum theory. With that luck.
But that was the minimal possible reparameterization invariant. If you also
include
the reparameterization invariant.
If you include the spatial, we'll see that next the coming lectures. But if you include the spatial, you get actual constraints that are linear spatial constraints. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. The point is that adding a space doesn't add anything to the discussion about time, which is why I'm talking about the time stuff now. Spatial things sort of do their separate thing, and they don't really interfere with any of what's going on here, which is kind of nice actually. But it works out that it's kind of lucky that it works out that way. So it's important to remember that. Maybe the idea is to go to the degrees of freedom, but that's difficult as well. And I think the first thing that I'm going to say next week is that for the spatial relationalism stuff, is that trying to write the theory in terms of the true degrees of freedom was something that people tried for 40 years or something, and then just couldn't write down a sensible theory. But Schrodinger was the last one to try. And then there was a couple of people in the 1800s, like around Mach's time, that tried, but didn't get anywhere. And then Julian came around and said, okay, why don't we just think of this as a gauge theory? And then everything made sense. So I don't know why it is that looking at these true degrees of freedom makes the thing so much more complicated, but seems to be the case. Okay, so obviously I don't have time to go, but this is a good place to stop because next week it'll be the spatial relationalism things, and it should be a lot cleaner and less sketchy. But I was hoping to sort of simulate discussions and get people thinking, and I realize that it is very hand-wavy, but if people want more references. The other thing I should have done is maybe look up the references. So if you are interested in specific references, I can provide them. Okay, any questions?
Can you send an email with a client?
Which one for the one in Maya? To the group or just to you?
Okay, all right. Send it to me.
To me.
I'll look some of these references.
I'm always using the internet.
One of the problems is that I prepared this when I was on the plane, so I didn't actually have access to the internet, so I couldn't look up all the references. So I follow
classification.
I know. I was doing physics on the beach the entire time.
Yeah.
It was not a vacation. It was.
I think we should all have a non-vacation like that.
Yeah. I'd recommend it. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.